Hello and welcome to Gilead. Thank you for tuning in and we appreciate you joining us. Listen to Reverend Vince Amlin give his first sermon back at Gilead since his sabbatical break. We are so happy to have him back and we hope you enjoy. Please listen now.
The bad news is the set break is over. The good news is the screaming part of their... their time together is over, too. You guys, this is the first sermon I get to preach here since Easter. Which is already overhyping the sermon I actually have to preach to you, but I'm really excited. I miss getting to do this. And I miss getting to do it with this happening. So afternoons in Spain were Daddy and Nola time. Nola is, if you don't know, is my daughter. I am Daddy. You don't need to call, you shouldn't call me Daddy. Anyway, Nola could only take so much siesta. Paul, no, don't do it. Nola could only take so much siesta. So while Rochelle rested, we explored Oviedo together. The geology museum, the art museum, cheesy souvenir shops. We tried various ice cream spots out. We visited every park in walking distance, and we bought some cookies off some nuns who gave us way more samples when I went with Nola than when I was by myself. And one afternoon, I took her to visit the cathedral. I was excited to see it, but I was even more excited to show her, because even though she has explicitly said many times that she has no interest in that God stuff, she had never been in a church that big or even in a room that big. And I didn't think that was like gonna convert her, but I wanted her to experience like cathedrals are made to wow us. And I was excited to see her wowed. Of course, as every parent knows, wanting your child to have any experience is a recipe for disappointment. So there was a particular path we were supposed to take inside the church, like on our tour. Down the center aisle of the sanctuary and out the right side, up these stairs to the Camara Santa, this holy chamber where all the relics of the cathedral were held, especially the most prized relic, the cloth that was wrapped around Jesus' head when he was buried. Like somehow Oviedo got that. Originally I wrote supposedly wrapped around Jesus' head. I do kind of like doubt it is the genuine article, but even if it isn't, there's evidence that this particular piece of bloodstained fabric has been treated that way for almost 1,500 years. Like, that's the documented history, which to me still gives that little scrap like a certain amount of holiness. All the faithful people who have come over a millennium to look on this symbol of Jesus' friends' care for him, to imagine it wound lovingly around his face, all those people wanting to get as close to it as they could. What else do you need to make something holy? This is probably the best we could do so far. Yeah, just keep going, Paul says. Nola could not have cared less about the cloth. But she was excited that right outside the Camara Santa was a screen where you could take a virtual tour of the room that she was refusing to take an actual tour of. So she pushed buttons while I waited my turn. To that point in our trip to the cathedral, even if it wasn't like full of meaning for her the way it was for me, we were having a good time. There was a lot to see. There was an air of mystery around all of it. She was asking questions, and I was getting to share things that matter to me. I was also trying to keep it breezy, like I had low expectations. I was happy to not spend any more time in any area than she wanted. And then we got to the museum. Three rooms in, giant crucifixion scene. Like Jesus' face twisted in agony, blood running down his head and side, and Nola froze. What's up, kiddo? Daddy, that's disgusting. Yep, it is. Let's get out of here. In the next room was a picture of the Mater Dolorosa, the Mother of Sorrows, like Mary weeping, inconsolable at the death of her child. Daddy, this is scaring me. In the next room, another crucifixion. Daddy, I want to get out of here. Okay, except we're like halfway through a museum with crucifixions in both directions. So I offered to like go ahead into the next room, see if it was safe, and then motion her in. But then in the following room, there was another one. So I told her, like, just don't look left. We're going to go through. Don't look left. Of course, she immediately looked left. She was transfixed, and I pulled her past it and on through the rest of the museum until we escaped into the cloister and then back into the sanctuary and out the back doors into the plaza, safe. For the next hour and much of the next week, and if you ask her about it, the next hour of your life, the crucifixion was all we talked about. She wanted to know why anyone would want to look at a picture like that. And I tried to explain my theology of the crucifixion to my 8-year-old. We need to look at it, I told her, because it's so disgusting. It's natural to think those pictures are awful. They are awful. They're supposed to remind us that it's possible for us to do awful things. That sometimes we do, all of us, and we shouldn't. She was unconvinced. We need to look at it, I tried another tactic, because even though it's sad and scary, what it represents is actually good. Jesus is God, and God saw that people were sad and scared. God saw that people were suffering and in pain, and God decided to join us. God chose to be near us, even in that pain. God hurts the way we hurt. She was unconvinced. We need to look at it. I gave her my final argument. We need to look at it because it reminds us that other people are suffering. You and I are fortunate. We have a house and food and people who love us. We're healthy, and most of the time we're happy. But we can't forget that that's not true for everyone. There are people in pain. There are people dying. There are people who are being oppressed, who are being executed right now. We can't look away from that suffering. We have to look at it to keep it in front of us. So it will remind us that it's part of our work to try to relieve that suffering wherever we see it. And she was still unconvinced. And for weeks, every time we were considering entering a church or a museum, I had to scout it out and see if it was safe before she would go in. So on another afternoon in Spain, in a different town, I left my mom and Nola at the apartment, and I went to see some of the holy sites. I hit the big important spots, and then I like wandered around a little until I came across this other church with its doors open and decided to duck in, kind of a completist for the churches of Padrón, Spain. It was a tiny chapel, which for some reason was playing really cheesy Spanish worship music, like schmaltzy stuff, and all the art was like of similar quality. It seemed like it was like hand-me-downs from the better churches in town. But the woman at the back of the sanctuary was nice, and I didn't want her to think I was just a tourist, so I ducked into the back row to pray. As I did, I realized there were no crucifixions in this church, or no big ones, at least, that I could notice. Instead, above the altar, in the most important part of the sanctuary, I saw a part of the story that I had never seen have that spot. The descendimiento, the part where Jesus' friends and family take him down from the cross so they can bury him, so they can wrap him in those cloths and place him in one of their family plots. I'd seen plenty of crucifixions in that spot and resurrections and various versions of Mary, but never that simple human scene of grief and love, of friends caring for their beloved one last time. It changed things for me to imagine, even for a moment, that that was the most important part of the story. What they're doing, it turns out, is what their scriptures told them to do. There's a passage in Deuteronomy, and real quick, I have to say, I definitely did not know this passage existed. Ez came up with it in like 10 seconds. So if you don't know, Ez is like a fucking boss on scripture. I almost said thank you, evangelicalism, but I will not say that from this pulpit. Anyway, there's a passage in Deuteronomy that I definitely don't skip every time I read the book. It's a rule in a long list of rules, and it says that if someone is put to death and his body is hung on a tree, you must not leave it overnight. Be sure to bury him the same day, because anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. It says you must not desecrate the land that your God is giving you as an inheritance. In those days, in some places, it was normal to do the Mad Max thing of hanging up the bodies of your enemies or of criminals, anyone whom you wanted to make an example out of, displaying their bodies as a sign, a reminder of the power of the state, of the reach of the law, as a lesson to be looked at and meditated on. And God tells the people of Israel, not you. That's not what you do. Doing that would desecrate the land I have given you, your inheritance. It would turn that gift into a curse. Looking at that violence and asking others to look at it would corrupt you. Meditating on killing and death, it will twist you into something you are not, something you were never meant to be. You are meant to be people who will take down the body, who care for it, who bury it on the same day. Now, do I wish this passage went further and said, like, maybe don't execute someone to begin with? Yes, but God is always meeting people where they are and moving them a little bit further. So in a world where people practice capital punishment and then leave the bodies up to intimidate others, the first step is to take them down, to realize what it does to us when we treat anyone that way, when we look on a scene like that day in and day out. In that chapel in Spain, I started to question everything I'd told Nola. Maybe we don't need to look at the crucifixion to remind us of our capacity for evil. Actually, God says it will do just the opposite. It will feed the impulse for violence, not stop it. And yes, God did come to suffer with us, to be near us in our pain, but maybe we don't need to look at the crucifixion to remember it, because God didn't do that so that we could reflect more on pain and suffering. God did it so that we would have relief from it, so that we would know we are cared for by one whose power outweighs every death-dealing power that threatens us. Yes, we can never forget that our neighbors are suffering. We cannot or should not ignore it, but maybe we don't need to look at the crucifixion in order to see it. Which is the better image for us to focus on, the suffering itself or the people who move in to care for it? The pain or the ones who, even after their friend can no longer feel it, act to relieve it? Maybe we don't need to look at the crucifixion. They said they were going to play the softer songs in the second half to help us out. It's coming, I'm sure. It's fine.
Sorry.
It's fine. No, you're good, Sean. It's not. It's fine. It's good. On another afternoon in Spain, Nola and I headed for the archaeology museum. She and I are very into learning about early humans, and northern Spain turned out to be a great place for that. It's full of cave paintings and important archaeological sites. We spent hours looking through the artifacts and imagining ourselves living 20 or 40,000 years ago in that place, trying to find the threads that connected our lives and theirs. In one of the display cases was a reproduction of a skeleton, laid out in just the way they'd found it in a nearby cave, curled up in a hollow carved out of the stone. Nola looked a little nervous, but also interested. Why do they have a skeleton in here? Yeah, that's a good question. Why would they want us to see this? Do you see the way she's laid out? on her side, her head resting by her hand. She looks almost like she's sleeping. See how she has different special objects around her? All of that tells archaeologists that someone put her there, just like this. When she died, the people who were with her, maybe her family and friends, they cared for her. They dug out this hollow and they laid her in it. They surrounded her with things they thought were important. They may have wrapped her in skins or put on special clothes. And thousands of years later, this is how they found her. And people have found lots of others like this. So that's how they know, how we know that for tens of thousands of years, maybe longer, people have been caring for each other like this. At their hardest moments, when they're sad and scared, when they've lost someone they love, they hold them and take them somewhere special and safe. And they care for them one last time, all the way back then and still now. It's part of what makes us human. That's why they put it in the museum, I think. Because it reminds us of who we are. It helps us think about how we want to live. It's something we need to look at.